Did you know the Bible has a whole book dedicated simply to complaining? That is Lamentations. And this week in the Ponder New podcast, that's the book we're looking at. I'm Pastor Rob Myallison. Happy for you to join me here as we ponder together Lamentations. Figure out what gave rise to this depth of complaint, but really what can we learn from it? And what I want us to delve into and to ponder is what can we say when we face situations in life where there doesn't seem to be anything that can be said.
Butterfly in the sky, I can go twice as high. Take a look, it's in a book, a reading rainbow.
The thought of my affliction and my homelessness is wormwood and gall. My soul continually thinks of it and is bowed down within me. But this I call to mind, and therefore I have hope. The steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. His mercies never come to an end. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. The Lord is my portion, says my soul. Therefore I will hope in him. The Lord is good to those who wait for him, to the soul that seeks him. It is good that one should wait quietly for the salvation of the Lord. It is good for one to bear the yoke in youth.
What do we say when there's nothing that can be said? Again, what do we say when the situation is so tragic, so horrific, so challenging, so overwhelming that we just don't feel like words suffice? I just was visiting with a woman who was a teacher for my children in elementary school. But she's had a brain, I think it might have been an aneurysm, injury of sorts, and it's really left her much, much limited. Almost impossible really for her to communicate. And it's just was profound to be with her and to think about this person who was so bubbly, so laughing, just a joy, made my kids, you know, really love to go to school, and now just to see this person in this state, and it was really difficult for me. And I felt when I was with her, I just felt like robbed of my confidence that I could say anything that could make sense, that could be of comfort. Again, we get to those situations where we know that there's really, well, not much that we can or feel like we should say, but yet somehow we want a response as humans. The Book of Lamentations, in many ways, is the words that can be said, the words that were said, and a time when nobody really knew what to say. The prophet Jeremiah, who we heard about last week, was prophesying around the time of the fall of Judea and Jerusalem. And after it fell, the city, it wasn't just that there was a change in a national border. And it wasn't just that their armies had lost. It went deeper than that. And for the people of ancient Judea, there was this sense that they had the temple of the Lord. And then no matter how bad they were, no matter how bad things got, that they sort of had the permanent goalie, like the best goalie in the world was finally there of God, and that God had saved the people so many times before that they kind of almost felt like invincible. Jerusalem and the temple could not fall because, well, God was on their side, and God would not let God's own temple be destroyed. And as they saw the temple overwhelmed by the Babylonians, the riches taken out, and then it just destroyed. This temple built by Solomon, this reminder of their glorious years and their lineage, the pride of their people, this temple. What did this say about them as a people? And what did this say about their God? And then furthermore, there was just the realities of war, not in the abstract far away, but up close, where the people saw that their leaders were being taken away in exile. And for a people for whom the religion had really focused on the temple and the practice of sacrifice, there was no more Day of Atonement for the people. Right? Their nation, their religion just kind of broke there, right before their eyes. And the people were scattered now. And as they say in the fifth chapter of Lamentations, that the women were defiled. The children become slaves. They saw the brutalities of war. And so this whole kind of just destruction of their homeland, the sort of virtual at that point seeming elimination of their religion and the torture of their people was just, what can you say? What can you say? And out of this grows then the Book of Lamentation. And Lamentation is put where it is in the Bible, probably for two reasons. The one is, well, Jeremiah prophesies about the fall of Jerusalem, and then that's what the Book of Lamentation specifically is about. And so it's sort of a poetic, emotional response to the events that Jeremiah is foretelling and that we sort of read about happening during the Book of Jeremiah. The other thing that's going on is that there is a subscript in the Greek version of Lamentations. Now, Lamentations in Greek and Hebrew are basically the same, whereas the Greek is a kind of a translation of the Hebrew. But there's a subscript in the Greek that's not in the Hebrew, and the subscript says that this was the dirge, the song of lament of Jeremiah, for when he saw what had happened in Jerusalem and Israel, he sat down and wept and then began to sing this song. What's also interesting is that in the Greek version of the Bible, it's put right after Baruch. And again, Baruch was Jeremiah's friend. So it may be that Jeremiah didn't write it, but that associates of Jeremiah were the ones that wrote it, or maybe he led a process of writing it and he kind of helped, was the one though to not perform it, but deliver it. All this to say that it is deeply embedded with the specifics of the ministry of Jeremiah and the time period that Jeremiah lived and this fall of ancient Jerusalem and the temple. But I'd like to offer that there are some things in this book that we can learn about what to say when there's nothing that can be said. So what can we learn from Lamentations about what to say when there's nothing to be said? Well, the short answer is sing. There's a sense that actually Lamentations is in itself a song. At the very least, it's a poem. The reason why we actually could considered a song is because in this Greek subscript that kind of again says, what this book is about, it says that Jeremiah wept and then he sang this dirge. There's actually one word in Greek for sing a dirge. And the word dirge is actually the name of the book in Greek. Like it's meant to be a song that is sung. And when you look at the actual Hebrew, there's a way in which you could not capture this in English. It would be so impossible. Because the Hebrew in the first four chapters of the book has each verse start with a sequential letter of the Hebrew alphabet. So the first verse of the first chapter starts with the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet, Aleph. The second verse of the first chapter has a word that starts with the second letter of the Hebrew alphabet, Beit. Third verse, first word, starts with the letter Gimel, then Dalet, and it just so forth. Hebrew has 22 consonants. There were really no vowels. So there's 22 verses, the chapters 1, 2, and 4. Chapter 3 is a little bit different. And what chapter 3 does, it has triple the number of verses, but that's because three verses at a time, it starts with the letter. So the first three verses start with a word that starts with the letter Aleph, 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 verses 4 through 6, Beit, 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 verses 7 through 9, Gimel, Gimel, Gimel. And what that's doing then is that you're just hearing, if you hear this in Hebrew, you're hearing sort of this repetition of beginning sounds. Furthermore, the Hebrew has its own rhythm to it, its own rhythm of accents, particularly like three accents in a row and then two that words that don't have as heavy an accent. Again, I don't speak Hebrew well enough to kind of let you hear this poetry. Perhaps you can go online and YouTube somebody reading this in Hebrew, and that could kind of maybe give you a sense of what this sounds like. But there's a particular sound to it, a rhythm. And there's also just kind of I don't want to say playful, but almost like, you know, when you had to write haikus in middle or high school or maybe elementary school, and you had to sort of, you know, pick the words in certain formats. I mean, there's a real rigid format here. And you might say, why is that, that you're going to take the deepest of emotions that these people are having about the destruction of everything that they've known, and we're going to put it into kind of like just this plug-and-play formula? What is going on there? Well, my sense is that when we get to really deep emotions, as humans, we need structure. Because we don't really know what we're supposed to say, and we don't even know kind of what the next step of life is. We're just kind of numb and overwhelmed, and structure at that point becomes really important. When I meet with families for funerals, there's been a desire, maybe in the last, 25, 30 years, for people to have an open mic at a funeral. And I'm not talking about a little gathering of like 5 or 10 people, you know, kind of sharing in an intimate kind of environment, or maybe even 20 kind of close family members. I'm saying, you know, 150, 200 people. And whenever families do this, I say, no, I'm not going to have an open mic. But furthermore, I want anybody who's speaking to have prepared notes ahead of time. And I think people think that I'm just trying to control. I actually don't. It doesn't matter to me what a person chooses to say. I'm actually doing it because most people underestimate how emotional they're going to be at those times. And they don't realize how much they would benefit themselves and really honor the person who's deceased by writing stuff down. And twice I've had people tell me that they didn't need to do it, like defiantly tell me they were good public speakers and they didn't need to do it. Both of them were not able to speak for very long and came up to me afterwards and said to me that they regretted not having written something down ahead of time. Turns out that sort of the higher the grief, the more the emotion that we have, the more we actually need stuff in writing, the more we need to have a form. And this is why I think for a funeral, I can't think of anything more comforting in a funeral than a bulletin. Because life at that point is so numb, so overwhelming, that I just want to know, like, okay, what's next? What's next? And I don't want to have to make any decisions. I don't want to have to think. I just want to kind of be led. And this is why I'm willing at funerals to have people read kind of psalms or prayers, because I just think people need words. We don't quite know what to say. And I'd even go a little bit further and say that I think what makes good art is actually structure. This is a little bit of a tangential point here. But, you know, the Bible doesn't just say like, oh, mercy is the forgiveness that is undeserved. It tells the story of the prodigal son. Or if you want to read a love story, you don't just say there was a boy who met a girl, they couldn't get along, but then they did, and they were all happy. Love is so powerful that it overcomes our foibles. No, you read the whole book of Pride and Prejudice. Or if you have daughters, you end up watching it in the DVD on long car trips, or even the book by tape. Right? But in other words, good art, whether it's a painting, whether it's a play, whether it's just a novel, a work of literature, it's not just raw emotion, but there's some sort of structure and there's some sort of form. And that I think for us as humans to really kind of plumb the depths of an emotion, to give voice to that which is inexpressible, like the realities of grief and love and our deepest hopes and our deepest fears, it kind of needs art. And that art has to have some sort of form for us to kind of process this, get into it, and kind of experience it. So what I think we can learn from the book of Lamentations is that grief requires art to process, and grief requires a bit of structure. And especially I think that art, weirdly around the darkest and most difficult of emotions and songs, there kind of needs to be a form to kind of contain it, but let us sit with it. But there's one more pearl of wisdom that I want to pull out of Lamentation. It's that when it comes to the unspeakables of life, ultimately, we're going to have to wrestle with God. That in the book of Lamentations, there's kind of speaking about what has happened. But the fifth chapter is ultimately an address to God. Like, just God. It's a prayer right to God. And when we go through the challenges of life, that's where we're going to end up. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that's where we start. I mean, the book of Lamentations just begins with sort of a taking stock of what has happened, a processing it. And then it also moves to a deep place of internal retrospection and confession, an acknowledgement that the people didn't do the right thing. And part of our grief in any situation is going to be our guilt. And unless you're truly a narcissist, in all situations in life where bad stuff happens, there's inevitably a sense that somehow we should have done something differently. I cannot tell you that I've been a pastor in all sorts of situations with people, and people somehow always manage to wonder if, well, to what extent it was my fault that we're in the situation that we're in. And so at some level, we're always in tragedy going to need a word of forgiveness. That somehow we, as we come to the conclusion again at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, that we did all we could, and at 2 a.m. feel like somehow this is all our fault, we're going to need ultimately a word of forgiveness. And so, again, part of the reality of grief is that intense part of it, that sort of a chapter within our lamentation, is going to be confession and forgiveness. Another thing that becomes so important in grief is ultimately to turn to God. And the third chapter of Lamentations is probably the most uplifting. And we get in the middle of it this beautiful word of great is thy faithfulness. You know, morning by morning, new mercies I see. And when we go through grief, ultimately we also have to wrestle with God, because we realize in those terrible of terrible situations that although we may have some capacity to improve the situation, that there's going to need to be new mercies. There's going to have to be a breakthrough from on high, a word outside of ourselves, a movement of something that's greater than ourselves to get us to a new situation. And so we're going to have to wrestle with God to remember, to wring out of the holy text some sort of word of grace and hope, to remind ourselves that in spite of how tragic things are, that God still lives. The end of the book of Lamentations is particularly haunting because it ends with an open-ended kind of question of sorts. The last chapter of Lamentations is no longer in a poetic form. It's just a prayer to God that God's mercy would finally kind of break in, that there could be a new day, that this mercy that they know exists with God on behalf of the people, that this could be real. But the last verse is kind of like, unless you actually are so angry that like you've permanently forgotten us. And wow, this is so intense here, because I think for most of us as moderns, we would just say in the light of suffering that there is no God. You know, how can we believe in God after the Holocaust or whatever? But for the ancients, there was no sense that God couldn't exist. God, of course, had to exist. And so what becomes the problem then is not God's non-existence, but God's forgetting us. God's choosing not to act on our behalf. And perhaps it's just easier to think there's not a God than to believe that God has forgotten us. But for those of us that are baptized, we have a promise. We have a claim on us that we belong to the Lord. That there is a God, and that God has chosen not to let us go. And so this means, though, that when things don't go the way that we think they should, and we're just overwhelmed by that sense of injustice, we have to go back to God. And if there was a Christian addendum to Lamentations, perhaps it could be more of a challenge to say, you have promised to be our God, so save us, Lord. But nonetheless, Lamentations reminds us that in all of these tragic situations, that ultimately we can ponder, we can do all sorts of things, but we're going to have to wrestle with God for forgiveness, for confession, for mercy, and for hope.